Welcome to the deep dive. We are well, not only fundamental, but kind of hidden in plain sight, how a liquid transforms into a structured solid.
It sounds simple, right? Water to ice, but it's incredibly complex.
Exactly. Think about it. This transition dictates the strengths, the durability, really the performance of every high-performance material around you. You know, from the structure of your car engine to the charging capacity of your phone battery.
Mm-hmm.
Our sources today are, well, they're pretty dense, but our mission is clear. We're unpacking the physics of solidification.
Getting into the nitty-gritty.
We've got some fascinating material, including a really striking visual hint of the forces at play. An image of dendritic ice growth, like little trees of ice captured during an Antarctica expedition.
Wow.
Yeah, it just shows that these rules govern freezing everywhere, you know, from a frozen continent right down to an industrial casting mold.
Same physics, different scale.
So you're about to get the shortcut to understanding these microstructural changes that happen during cooling. Specifically, we want to know why some liquids form smooth, uniform solids and why others decide to branch out into those complex microscopic trees known as dendrites.
Right.
We'll focus on the critical interplay between, well, heat flow and chemical composition.
Okay, so to start, let's establish the fundamental driver here. Solidification, it needs an energy deficit. It has to happen below the equilibrium freezing point, which we scientists call T-dollars.
Right, the melting point.
Exactly. And the difference between the actual temperature and that T-dollars, that's called undercooling, or delta T.
Okay, undercooling, got it.
The speed, or you could say the velocity, at which that solid-liquid interface moves, it's directly proportional to that undercooling. So more undercooling means faster freezing. Simple relationship there.
Makes sense. Colder equals faster.
But what's fascinating here is how resistant liquids actually are to starting the process spontaneously. If you have a perfectly pure liquid, maybe in a perfect container, something called homogeneous nucleation, just a crystal popping into existence on its own, it's incredibly difficult.
Really?
Oh, yeah. In experiments, scientists often have to supercool a liquid by hundreds of degrees Celsius, sometimes, like up to 200 cirque-dixit-dollars just to force it to start crystallizing.
200 degrees. Wow. So liquids really want to stay liquid.
They do. But fortunately for manufacturers, we almost never deal with perfect containers or perfectly pure liquids.
Oh, yeah.
In the real world, solidification almost always begins by what we call heterogeneous nucleation. It kicks off on imperfections, little bits of dust, or most often just the cold surface of the mold itself.
Okay, so the mold wall gives it a place to start. That makes things easier.
Much easier.
All right, let's unpack this by starting with the simplest scenario. Pure metals. This is cleaner because the solid and the liquid, they have the exact same composition. Growth here is controlled entirely by how efficiently heat flows away from that solid-liquid interface.
Just heat management, basically.
Yeah. And this gives us our first big rule. Stability relies on self-correction. We call this stable planar growth. It happens when the heat gradient in the liquid, joule dollars, is positive.
Meaning it gets hotter as you move away from the solid.
Exactly. The temperature increases as you move away from the interface and into the bulk liquid.
Okay.
And here's the key mechanism. If a tiny bump, like a little perturbation, tries to form on their otherwise smooth interface, it starts poking out into the surrounding liquid.
Which is warmer.
Which is slightly warmer than the freezing point, T-dollars.
Yeah.
So the local temperature right at the tip of that bump is now too high. It's above the melting point.
Ah, so it melts back.
Instantly. It remelts immediately. That self-correction keeps the growth front nice and flat, planar, or maybe columnar, but organized.
Neat. Like a self-healing surface?
Kind of, yeah. Now, contrast that stable picture with what happens when the heat flow flips, leading to thermal dendritic growth. This is where the solid-liquid interface becomes unstable because we have a negative heat gradient in the liquid. Joule dollars is less than zero.
Okay, so now it's colder further out in the liquid. How does that happen?
Well, this negative gradient often occurs when the melt is severely undercooled to begin with. When the atoms lock into place, crystallize, they release latent heat.
Oh, right? The heat of fusion.
Yeah. If the liquid ahead of the solid is already very cold, that latent heat can't escape fast enough. It actually warms up the interface itself.
So the interface is the hottest spot.
Exactly. It creates this layer where the temperature is highest right at the interface, and then it drops as you move out into the bulk liquid. That's your negative gradient.
Okay, I see. And what's the consequence?
Well, now think about that little perturbation, that bump. It advances into liquid that's even more supercooled.
Colder liquid, so it grows faster.
Yes. It grows faster, which releases more latent heat right there at the tip, further amplifying the instability. It's a runaway growth process.
And that leads to those tree-like structures.
That's exactly it. The familiar, sometimes chaotic, tree-like dendrites.
And the ice example you mentioned.
Perfect real-world case. That incredible image in the sources, the ice dendrites forming on the inside of a window pane when it's freezing outside. That's exactly this process.
Uh-huh.
The interface where the moisture is actually freezing, it's momentarily warmer than the glass surface itself because of that latent heat release. That generates the negative temperature gradient that encourages the instability in all that branching growth.
Makes sense. A beautiful example of physics in action.
So that distinction stable planar versus unstable dendritic, it perfectly explains the kind of layered structure we find when we pour metal into a cold mold, like in a classic aluminum ingot casting.
Right, you see distinct zones.
You do. Right up against the cold mold wall, you have the chill zone. This is where the metal basically panics right against the cold wall. You get massive, rapid undercooling.
See, tiny crystals.
Yeah, a fine layer of tiny equiaxed, meaning roughly equal dimensions crystals, they nucleate incredibly fast.
Okay, that's the first layer. Then what?
Then the competitive race begins in the columnar zone. These grains start growing inwards, directly against the direction of heat flow. Now, in materials like lithium or aluminum, their crystal structure actually favors growth along specific axes.
Like highways for atoms.
Sort of, yeah. For cubic structures like these, it's often the $100 directions.
Okay.
So the grains, whose preferred growth direction is most perfectly aligned, growing straight towards the center, anti-parallel to the heat flow, they just grow faster. They swiftly stifle their less favored neighbor.
Survival of the fittest grain?
Pretty much. They become dominant, and you get this coarsening effect, resulting in those elongated columnar structures reaching deep into the liquid metal.
I see. So it gets coarser as you go inwards.
Generally, yes. And then finally, you often get a central equiax zone right in the middle. This can form either from fragments that maybe broke off the mold wall and got swept inwards, or maybe from new particles nucleating near the center as it cools.
And there's often that dip in the middle, right? The pipe.
Almost always. You see a central pipe or shrinkage cavity. That's just the material contracting as the very last bit of liquid finally solidifies. Liquid metals shrink when they freeze, unlike water.
Right. Important difference.
And thinking about those columnar grains, especially in metals like lithium,
mm-hmm.
Well, that leads directly to why this microscopic process is so critical to modern safety. We're talking about the nightmare scenario of lithium dendrites in batteries.
Yes, very topical.
Extremely.
When you look at the structure of lithium metal, it's body-centered cubic, BCC. And like you said, it prefers that high-speed $100 growth direction.
Okay.
Now, during rapid charging of a lithium-ion battery, if the lithium metal deposits too quickly onto the negative electrode, well, it doesn't deposit smoothly. It forms those needle-like dendrites.
Following those fast growth directions.
Exactly. And because they are sharp and they grow aggressively, they can physically pierce right through the separator layer that's supposed to keep the positive and negative electrodes apart.
Oh, that sounds bad.
It's very bad. That breach creates an internal short circuit. You get massive current flow, thermal runaway.
And the battery can catch fire.
Precisely. As we've unfortunately seen, it's a failure mode dictated entirely by this microscopic solidification physics, but with potentially catastrophic macro-level safety consequences.
Wow. Okay, so for pure materials, it's largely about heat flow controlling speed and shape, potentially leading to dangerous dendrites. But here's where it gets, I think, really interesting. We have to throw a chemical wrench into the system. What happens when we introduce a second element, when we make an alloy?
Yeah, things get more complicated.
Solidification is no longer just about heat anymore, is it?
Not at all. In alloys, as the solid forms, the alloying element, we call it the solute, has to decide where it wants to go. It partitions, meaning it distributes itself, between the solid phase, which we can denote CCSL for concentration in the solid at the interface, and the liquid phase, CSL.
So the different elements prefer different phases.
That's right. We quantify this using something called the partition coefficient, pick a P. It's defined simply as the ratio of the concentration in the solid to the concentration in the liquid right at the interface. PP equals CCLS, CLS.
Okay, partition coefficient, what does it tell us?
It's essentially the material's pickiness factor. For most common alloys, KPP is actually less than 1.
Less than 1.
Meaning the solid phase is like a picky eater. As it forms, it prefers not to incorporate the solute atoms. It constantly spits them out, rejecting them back into the liquid right ahead of the growing interface.
So the liquid near the solid gets enriched in the solute.
Exactly. That solute piles up just ahead of the solidification front. And this partitioning difference is absolutely crucial. If you could cool an alloy agonizingly slowly under true equilibrium conditions, then diffusion within the solid itself could, theoretically, keep up. Atoms could move around enough to constantly homogenize the composition.
And you'd end up with a uniform solid.
You'd end up with a perfectly uniform structure, yes.
But that's not realistic, is it?
Almost never in practice. Manufacturing means cooling happens much too fast. Diffusion in the solid state is just incredibly slow compared to the speed of solidification. Atoms in the solid are essentially locked in place. They can't rearrange fast enough to maintain equilibrium as the temperature drops.
So what happens instead?
This leads to what we call a cored structure, which is the result of non-equilibrium solidification. Think of a copper-nickel alloy, maybe one that's 35% nickel overall. See other dollars, 35 text, 30% nickel.
Okay. According to the phase diagram, the very first bit of alpha solid to form will actually be much richer in nickel, maybe around 46% nickel.
Higher than the average. Right. But because the solid keeps rejecting nickel into the liquid as it grows, the liquid becomes progressively depleted in nickel. So the last bit of liquid to freeze will solidify into solid that's significantly poorer in nickel, maybe less than the original 35%.
Wait a minute. If the first solid is 46% nickel, and the last bit is less than 35%, does that mean virtually every single grain we cast, unless it's done incredibly slowly, has this massive chemical flaw, this concentration gradient, built right into it from center to edge?
Yes, exactly right.
Are you telling me that almost every metallic material we rely on is fundamentally heterogeneous, chemically zoned at the micro level?
That is the reality of almost all casting and solidification processes. It's called microsegregation or coring. And when metallographers etch these samples to look at them under a microscope, the regions that were the last to solidify, the parts rich in those rejected solutes, maybe like manganese and steel, they react differently to the etching chemicals.
Ah, creating visible patterns.
Exactly. They often appear as darker regions, outlining the original dendritic or cellular structure. The material is chemically zoned, revealing the history of its solidification.
Okay, this is huge. And it brings us, I think, to the ultimate aha moment of alloy solidification. If our rule back in pure metals was basically positive heat gradient equals stable planar growth,
Right. Heat flows out, interface stays flat.
then why, when we often try to follow that rule with alloys, setting up a positive temperature gradient, trying to keep the liquid slightly warmer than the solid, why do we still almost always end up with complex, unstable, tree-like dendritic structures? The pure metal rule seems to have broken.
Ah, good question. The rule didn't break, it gained a chemical constraint, or maybe a chemical complication is a better way to put it. This instability in alloys, even with a positive thermal gradient, is almost entirely due to constitutional supercooling, or CS.
Constitutional supercooling.
It's the direct result of that solute rejection we just discussed. Remember how the rejected solute piles up in the liquid just ahead of the interface?
Yeah, the liquid gets concentrated right there.
Well, that highly concentrated liquid now has a much, much lower freezing point, or liquidus temperature, TLSs, than the bulk liquid further away. So the local liquidus temperature drops steeply right at that interface because of the chemistry.
So the concentration of impurities effectively creates a chemical, like a freezing point depression zone right there.
Precisely, a very localized zone where the liquid should freeze at a much lower temperature than the liquid further out. Now, compare the actual temperature gradient in the liquid, TDOA, with the gradient of the liquidus temperature, a TLDUA, caused by this solute pileup.
Okay.
Even if the actual temperature is increasing away from the interface, a positive thermal gradient, which should be stabilizing, if that actual temperature gradient is less steep than the gradient of the freezing point caused by the rejected solute. You follow?
I think so. The actual temperature isn't rising fast enough to overcome the drop in freezing point caused by the solute.
Exactly. You've created a zone just ahead of the interface where the actual temperature of the liquid is below its own local composition-dependent freezing point.
Right.
That pocket of liquid is constitutionally supercooled.
So it's supercooled relative to its own chemistry, even if it's not supercooled relative to the bulk alloy's melting point.
You've got it. That's the key. That pocket is the constitutionally supercooled zone.
And in that CS zone, the nice smooth planar interface is basically doomed.
Completely unstable. Any tiny disturbance, any little bump on that smooth surface, now advances into liquid that is already effectively supercooled relative to its local composition. Instead of remelting like in the pure metal case,
it's instantly stable and just keeps growing.
It expands rapidly. And you actually see a progression here in the structure that forms.
Oh.
At low levels of constitutional supercooling, the instability might just start with gentle, rounded bumps forming. We call that cellular growth. Kind of looks like the tops of cauliflower. But as the level of solute buildup increases, maybe because you're solidifying faster or the partition coefficient is smaller, the constitutional supercooling gets more severe. Those cell caps extend further, they become sharper, and eventually they start branching violently.
To form the deep, complex, fully developed dendrites that we see dominating the microstructure of most industrial castings.
That's the progression from planar to cellular to dendritic, all driven by the severity of constitutional supercooling.
So the takeaway here is really that if you want that perfect planar front in an alloy, which sometimes you desperately need for specific applications, you have to ensure that the actual thermal gradient is high enough to physically overwhelm the chemical effect of the rejected solute. You have to eliminate that constitutionally supercooled zone.
That's the goal for controlled solidification.
So practically speaking then, what are the main levers we have to pull to try and control this? To actively reduce the tendency to form dendrites and alloys. It seems like it boils down to maybe speed, heat, and chemistry.
That's a great way to put it, yes.
Okay, first, speed. You mentioned cooling alloys agonizingly slowly for equilibrium. So does going slow help prevent dendrites too?
Absolutely. A low growth rate, dollar small, is crucial. Going slow gives the rejected solute more time to diffuse away from the interface into the bulk liquid. It increases the effective diffusion distance, which is roughly dollars, where D is the diffusion coefficient.
Ah, so slowing down, dollar small, effectively spreads out that pileup.
Exactly. It levels out the concentration gradient ahead of the interface, which reduces or eliminates the constitutional supercooling effect. So, slow is stable.
Okay, liver one.
Yes.
Slow down. Liver two. Heat. We need to fight that chemical freezing point depression with actual temperature.
Right. You need a large positive temperature gradient, the TDU large, in the liquid, a very steep temperature increase away from the interface.
Why steep?
Because that steep gradient physically heats the liquid faster than the solute pileup can drop its freezing point. If TTU is large enough, it can completely eliminate the constitutionally supercooled zone, even if there's solute rejection happening.
Got it. High heat gradient keeps everything above its local freezing point. Lever three, chemistry. You mentioned the partition coefficient, KP dollars.
Yes. The ideal scenario is to have a large partition coefficient, KP large, meaning KP dollars is close to one.
Why close to one?
Because if KP dollars is close to one, it means the solid and liquid prefer roughly the same composition, CSL6. Very little solute gets rejected into the liquid in the first place.
Less rejection means less pileup.
Exactly. Less pileup means a much smaller drop in the local liquid as temperature ahead of the interface, which minimizes or prevents constitutional supercooling. So choosing alloying elements that are less picky, that have a KP dollar closer to one, helps maintain stability.
Slow speed, high heat gradient, and pick alloys where the solute doesn't get rejected so much. Simple, right?
Yeah, it's simple in principle, maybe. But ultimately, this requirement for a highly stable interface is a major materials science bottleneck. Avoiding constitutional supercooling completely is incredibly difficult in practice. Because the required growth velocity usually has to be extremely small to satisfy the stability condition, especially in concentrated alloys, we're talking potentially microns per second. That's just too slow for most efficient industrial manufacturing processes like casting or welding.
So compromises have to be made.
Always. This is precisely why, when extreme microstructural uniformity is absolutely mandatory, like when you're growing single crystals of silicon for high-end semiconductors or special turbine blades, we have to use complex, highly controlled directional solidification techniques. These rely on imposing very steep temperature gradients and using agonizingly slow, controlled growth rates.
Paying a high price in time and complexity for perfection.
You are. Dendrites aren't some weird oddity of freezing. They're the natural consequence of trying to freeze almost any alloy reasonably quickly. They're the default state in many ways.
Okay, so let's try to sum this up. It feels like we've covered a lot of ground from simple freezing to complex alloys. For pure metals, the stability of the final solid shape planar or dendritic, it's a relatively simple competition, decided by heat flow alone. Is the gradient positive or negative?
Right. Jelly yellow dictates stability.
But as soon as you add alloying elements, the game becomes dominated by constitutional supercooling. It's this complex interplay between heat flow and the chemical partitioning of impurities at the interface.
That solid pileup changes everything.
Yeah. And the final shape of your material, its microstructure, is dictated entirely by whether a small disturbance just remelts, or whether that pocket of rejected chemistry, that constitutionally supercooled zone, lets it keep growing into a cell or a full-blown dendrite.
That captures it perfectly. Heat flow versus constitutional supercooling.
So we've established pretty clearly that speed, high solidification speed, is generally the enemy of microstructural uniformity. It leads to these complex, often weaker, dendritic and cored structures because solid-state diffusion just can't keep up.
Right. Diffusion is the bottleneck.
So here's a final thought to leave you with. Given that structural integrity is fundamentally tied to avoiding these rapid solidification defects, defects limited by the slow speed of diffusion, how far can material science truly push rapid processes? Things like high-speed additive manufacturing, 3D printing metals, or the extremely fast charging of a battery, which is essentially rapid deposition.
Yeah.
How fast can we go before the resulting non-equilibrium microstructure fundamentally compromises the material strength, its function, or even its safety?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? Where is that limit? Think about what you now know about solidification, about dendrites and coring. Every time you see a material being rapidly formed, cast, welded, printed, or even just rapidly charged, how close to the edge are we pushing it?